Hello and thanks once again for taking the time to download and listen to a podcast from CelticUnderground.net. I am Harry Brady and this is podcast number 245. Regular listeners will know we like our eclectic mix of guests here on the Celtic Underground podcast, trying to mix up between general Celtic chat and some interesting people with a wider knowledge of the football world. Normally they are brought to you by St Anthony, the unusual guest that is, but this week it's me. And once again this week we choose a man from the world of journalism and also a man from the Emerald Isle. It is a voice familiar to those of you who listen regularly to Radio Scotland. It is Mr. Tom English. Before I get on to giving you a pre-podcast CV of Mr. English, I'd just like to say that Wednesday night against Dundee, excellent game of football, as it was, the thing before the game that made me most proud to be a Celtic supporter was the work of the ordinary fans in the food bank donations, which piled up on the Celtic Way prior to the game. Over £30,000 worth of food came in for food banks and really showed why we are more than a club. It was organised by the fans and supported by the foundation and working with the foundation, but it was principally a fan-led effort, which again is a testament to the club and our fans and what makes us different. The Celtic FC Foundation, as you know, gets a regular plug on here. And at the moment, they are pulling together people who are interested in the 2015 Ben Nevis Huddle, which falls on the success of the 2013 and 14 events where supporters scaled Britain's highest mountain and performed the hurdle at 4,408 feet, middle of June, but in the snow. The 2015 event will take place on Saturday, June the 13th, where participants will start from the Glen Nevis Centre. And if you want to take part, you need to commit to raising a minimum of £125 after entry fee for the Celtic FC Foundation. Registration is open now on a first-come, first-served basis, and you can do that online or emailing cfcfoundation@celticfc.co.uk or phoning 0141 551 4262. There's also the 1888 Charity Shield event on May the 31st, which is the annual seven-a-side tournament sponsored by Ace Refrigeration for the third year now, taking place at Lennox Town. There is the skydive, not for me, I can do lots of things, but not the skydive. On July the 4th, 2015, 20 people will take part, 10,000 feet up, you jump out of a plane. As I say, it's not for me. Lots of people listen to this from various bits around the world. So whether you're one of the 8 people who downloaded the last podcast from Vietnam, or one of the 24 people who downloaded the podcast from China, or even the 3 people who downloaded from Mongolia, and those are not made up stats, by the way, you can contribute if you want, and if you're in the UK, you can contribute if you want. You can text, don't know how you text from abroad, so you'll know better than me. You can text CELT, CELT07, followed by £1, £5, £10, to 770, that's 70070, or easier online from abroad, I imagine. www.celticfc.net/charity/donate. You can take cash to a Celtic store, but that's not from abroad, that's here. And you can send a cheque to the Celtic FC Foundation. Or you can decide to come back and do one of these fantastic events. And of course, we will have more in the next few podcasts. But now, back on to the bold Tom. A voice familiar to those who listen to Radio Scotland on a regular basis and also download the podcast if you're overseas. Tom, first reporter on Scottish football in the early 90s, covering the Fergus McCann takeover. It left and came back in 2005 and to become a regular in the Scotsman, stroke Scotland on Sunday, and then on to Radio Scotland, where he's now a permanent fixture. This Limerick man is a Limerick United and Liverpool fan, but patently also loves Scottish football. So, Enough of me. This is me, Harry Brady, with him, Tom English.
So, Tom, you're an Irishman reporting on football in Scotland.
I am.
How the hell did you end up in Scotland? Tell people where you're from, because I did try to go on Wikipedia. There's no Tom English Wikipedia entry. As a journalist, you need to change that.
Thank goodness for that. I'm from Limerick, in the Midwest of Ireland, people would know. Hometown of the Cranberries and Terry Wogan.
You're not wearing a wig, it's obviously...
I'm not wearing a wig, no. And I moved, it's actually my second stint in Scotland. I joined the Sunday Times as a trainee stroke messenger in 1991. Mm-hmm. And as part of my traineeship, it was a 3-month stint in the Sunday Times in Kinning Park, where they used to be based.
Yeah.
So I came up here in the autumn of 1992. The first time I'd ever been in Scotland. Mm-hmm. I was put in a B&B for a week, which was owned by Andy Lynch.
Oh, right. Yeah.
I was supposed to stay for 3 months, and I stayed for 4 years. Mm-hmm. And I met my wife, Glaswegian, here. Then we went back to Ireland for 8 years. And then in 2005... Scotland on Sunday, and the Scotsman rang me up and offered me a very appealing job. And my wife, being a proud Glaswegian, said, "We're going." Mm-hmm. So we came, and about a year ago, I joined the BBC full time. So that's been me, and it's great. I love Scotland. I love Ireland as well, obviously.
Yeah,
but I can see myself staying here possibly for the duration. Never say never, but I'm very settled here. Two kids now. One was born in Ireland, one was born in Scotland, but both of them speak with a Scottish accent now.
So 1991, that was your start in journalism?
Yeah.
So what were you just doing everything? Was it a bit of doing everything?
Yeah, well, when I came up, I started in the Sunday Times in 91, and I was moved around the desk, news desk, sports desk. I always wanted to do sport. I was a sports fanatic since I was in short pants. And initially it was football, and then it was rugby, and then it was golf, and it was all of the tennis. It was played everything. Mm-hmm. I was rubbish at all of them, but I was very passionate about all of them. When I joined the Sunday Times, I was desperate to get into sport, and the sports editor of the Sunday Times at the time was a fellow called Chris Navrat. And you talk about, luck. He just, he took a shine to me. Maybe mm-hmm. he saw that I was passionate about my sport, took me under his wing, really looked after me. And then there was another guy who was the Scottish editor when I moved up here, a fellow called Tony Alloway, and was just brilliant, and I wanted to do write about football when I came up here, and he said, "On you go." And he kind of threw me in at the deep end, and he was very patient with me, and I was desperately bolshy and full of my own self-importance.
Yeah.
Not a lot has changed then, there, of course, but he was brilliant with me, absolutely brilliant, and he taught me an awful lot about journalism, and it was great. I loved it. The minute I set foot in Glasgow, I loved it. Saw a bit of the country, loved it even more. And the football thing was kind of alien to me, really, because while I watched an awful lot of football, and my two teams were Limerick United mm-hmm. and Liverpool,
right,
and they were my two teams. But it was Limerick United, because I used to go and watch Limerick United. They were, and my favourite player at the time was a fellow called Johnny Walsh, who nobody will have heard of, but Johnny Walsh was a creative central midfielder for Limerick United in the late 70s and early 80s.
A Paddy McCourt type player?
But a bit more dig,
right.
Maybe a little less flair, not quite Roy Keane, maybe a Paul Scholes type.
Right, okay.
Kind of, it was, a really smart footballer. And he worked in a carpet shop mm-hmm. in the middle of Limerick. I remember going in there as a boy of 8, 9, 10 into a carpet. Now, what would a boy of 8, 9, or 10 go in on his own to a carpet shop for? And they must have looked at me thinking I was a complete weirdo. But I went in just to have a look. Oh my God, gosh, Johnny Walsh. You know? So he was accessible and he was there. My other hero was Kenny Dalglish, a Liverpool fan. And it was really, you know, all over my bedroom wall was that Liverpool team, Dalglish's team. But he was like, he was this mythical figure. Mm-hmm. You know, it was only 1983 when my father brought me over to Anfield for the first time. But it was like, I never thought I would ever see Kenny Dalglish in the flesh.
Yeah.
You know, he was like a god. As Johnny Walsh, I could go and see, you know, the odd time he might look at me, I'd be very excited. So there were my two teams. And to start writing about them, with football, I mean, that's the old mantra, isn't it? If you can't play about it, you write about it. Mm-hmm. I've been lucky. I've been lucky. I've got the breaks at the right time to get into the job that I really love doing.
So your first two teams in Limerick and Liverpool. Mm. So do you remember anything about your first ever game that you went to see?
I couldn't remember what it was. I would have been seven.
There won't
or
be
eight.
Some people from Limerick listen to this. So
yeah, I can't remember, but I could name the team. You know, I could name that team. And you know, we had some good. We played in Europe. We won the League of Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
We played in Europe. We played Real Madrid. And we drew 2-2 with them in Dublin. The match had to be moved to Dublin because the Markets Field was Limerick's ground, was too small. We moved it to Lansdowne Road. We drew 2-2 with Real Madrid.
When was that?
That was 1980.
Mm-hmm.
1980, yeah. And Des Kennedy was the centre forward for Limerick United. Big kind of target man, but he was a kind of Berbatov type, you know. Right. That's the first time Des Kennedy has ever been compared to Berbatov. But, you know, and he had a big moustache. He looked like a porn star. You know, he was brilliant. He was a class footballer. And I'd been able to go to an awful lot of games, you know, Shamrock Rovers and Athlone Town and Bohemians and, you know, Home Farm. All these teams, they used to come to Limerick. I used to go up to Dublin as often as I could to watch them and around the country. I suppose one of the most, we played Southampton, which was Kevin Keegan's Southampton in Europe. They played a friendly match, I think in 81, after Spurs had just won the FA Cup.
Mm-hmm.
Played it at Thomond Park, where Munster play rugby now. And it was 5-1, I think, to Spurs. And Glenn Hoddle scored 4 of the most amazing goals.
Mm-hmm.
I remember running onto the pitch to try and get his autograph afterwards.
Hooligan.
And he ran over the top of me. He actually literally knocked me down on the ground. But again, it was like my first sight of a kind of real superstar, Glenn Hoddle, you know. And my father worked at the time with the manager of Limerick's team, a fellow called Owen Hand, their manager. Went down to manage Ireland.
Ireland, yeah.
My dad worked with him at the time. And my dad came home the night after. And he said to my brother and myself, go out to the boot of the car. There's something in there. So we went out to the boot, opened it up, and there was the ball that they'd played with. And we were like, my brother was a Spurs fan, so he slept with the ball. Gosh, Glenn Hoddle scored 4 goals with this ball. I couldn't believe it. You know, we had to give it back a couple of days later. I don't know where it is now. But I could still see it. It was all multi-colored.
You're taking it back. They didn't have enough balls to...
There was one ball, and multi-colored. Ball, I can still see it now, you know. So that was it, you know. Football is my friend, even though I'm, you know, I love my rugby and I've written for years about rugby. Football really as a kid was my first love.
So in Limerick, I take it would have been a limited amount of English football you'd have got to see on the television.
Yeah, match of the day.
Yeah,
that was it, and we were allowed. I mean, my mother tells me that I became a Liverpool fan at the age of 5, as much as you can be a fan at the age of 5, when I fell over on the road and I cut the knee out of my trousers, and she bought me a Liverpool patch for the knee of my trousers in the shape of a thumb. Thumb was up.
Oh, yeah, those are all the
Liverpool rule,
okay.
And I became a Liverpool, because I liked red and I liked my patch on my trousers, and I became a Liverpool fan. But we didn't see them. We were allowed to stay up when I was, you know, 7, 6, 7, 8.
Mm-hmm.
Allowed to stay up on Saturday night if Liverpool were on.
And then
no, we never. Well, we had Starsky, and I couldn't be bothered with that. You know,
oh, I was on at 9, and then Match of the Day would be on at 10.
I know. I've never into this. A lot of Starsky and Hutch. No, and I've never into that. Yeah, you know? It was all about Match of the Day for me. And you were there, and you didn't know what was coming up, and you didn't know if Liverpool were going to be the game, and you'd be praying, oh God. Liverpool, because it wasn't Liverpool, you had to go to bed. Mm. Allowed to stay up if it was Liverpool.
But what if it was, those Spurs weren't doing so well at that time? No, they weren't.
But we used to, myself and my brother Alan, who's also a journalist, the editor of the Limerick Leader, actually, a newspaper, formerly deputy sports editor of the Sunday
Times. Is he older or younger than you?
He's 4 years older. Yeah. Right. But he was a Spurs fan, and we used to have terrible fights, you know. I remember Liverpool played Spurs. In the might have been the Milk Cup final back then,
I think he played with the white ball with the white. Red,
that's right, yeah. And it was, you know what I mean. Television, Ronnie Whelan and Ian Mulvey and all these guys, Ian Rush. I think Spurs were 1-0 up at half time, and myself and my brother used to tear strips off each other. Spurs were 1-0 up at half time. I remember going up to the bedroom and kneeling down by the side of the bed and praying to God, please let Liverpool win this match. I don't think I can handle my brother, the slagging I'm going to get. And we won 2-1, Ronnie Whelan.
Isn't that then God taking sides over you, over your
brother? Absolutely.
Are you the chosen
just
one?
just showed that he was a Liverpool fan. So I let my brother have it in no uncertain terms. It was great.
So you get across to Anfield in 83. Did your brother get to White Hart Lane?
No, he didn't. He started to go to White Hart Lane when he was a bit older, 16, 17, 18, and we used to go over to London working on building sites for summers, which was great, which is really the best thing I ever did in my life, actually, was to go over there in my fifth year in high school or secondary school. I went over there for a summer and then went over for lots of summers afterwards while I was in college. It was great, and I got to see a lot more Liverpool going over there, pre-season friendlies and that. But he went to live in London about, you know, when he was about 18, and he went to see Spurs all the time. But he used to get, and he still has them, entire season's worth of Spurs programmes, going back to the early 70s. Mm-hmm. He'd been collecting these things for maybe 15, 20 years before he ever set foot at White Hart Lane, you know. He still has volumes of these things. He takes absolute immense pride in them. It's the kind of things that football fans
do. You think your remoteness from the, not to demean Irish football, but from the bigger game, made you more passionate about it?
Yeah, I would actually, yeah. I would. Because we saw Match of the Day and that was it. And remember, up until I was about, I don't know, maybe 10, 11 maybe? We only had two channels. We had RTE1 and RTE2. We didn't have any BBC. They had it up in Dublin.
Yeah.
But we didn't have it in Limerick. So it was only maybe 9 or 10. But RTE used to get kind of bits of Match of the Day. Mm-hmm. We used to see it that way. We used to see a little bit. But that was all we would ever see was Match of the Day. So these guys were absolutely on a pedestal. And I remember when I went to Anfield in 83 for the first time. And it's still... I'll tell you another story in a minute, but the greenness of the grass is something that still lives with me now. We came up the steps with my dad and my brother, and I looked out. It was the first time I'd ever been in a proper football stadium, you know, in Markets Field. God bless it, but it was, you know, it was a bit ramshackle. Yeah. And the greenness of the grass was like, wow, never seen anything like it. And my nephew was over, he's 15, he was over a couple of, about a month or two ago. And I brought it to see, unfortunately, Celtic versus St. Johnston, which didn't go too well for Celtic that night. But we were driving home anyway, and I said, what do you think? And he said, the grass. I thought, oh my God, it took me back to Anfield, the grass. Mm-hmm. I said, what about the massive stand and stuff? No, it was the grass and your man's goal. Was it Swanson scored the goal?
Yeah.
The goal and the grass. And he thought, when he said the grass, I thought, oh, yeah. I remember being young.
But the other thing that we won't get, because I still now, if I'm outdoors and smell a must be a certain type of cigarette or somebody smoking a pipe.
Mm.
I still think of my first Celtic game. Because that was the first time I'd smell. You'd smell cigarette and pipe smoke's got a different smell indoors and outdoors.
Yeah.
And this is the first time I'd really smelling it outdoors.
Yeah.
So when I smell it with someone walking behind someone in the street, it will sometimes take me back to that.
Well, it is. It's like a song. A song will trigger certain emotions and memories in your life. And that's a long time ago, 1983. But the grass is still, I mean, it's still so clear, so vivid in my mind.
So you were a bit detached. Mm. You didn't get to see any Scottish football.
No. What we saw, there was a program called Sunday Sport in the evening about 9 o'clock on RTE. And if it was a Celtic or Rangers match, or if it was a Celtic Aberdeen, if it was a big match in Scotland, they'd show you the goals. That was it. So it'd be like a minute or 2 minutes, you know. And that was it. The only other access you might have to it is Shoot magazine, or you know, Roy of the Rovers, mm-hmm. or Scoop from Scoop, pictures, and focus on favorite movie and all that kind of stuff, you know, and you might get the odd Scottish player in there. Well, you would get Scottish players in there, but no, I turned up. I have to say, I turned up in Scotland in the end of '92. Totally unaware. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know the big stuff.
Yeah.
But in terms of the ins and outs and the players and the ball, I didn't know a lot.
So, at that time, Rangers were in the ascendancy. You had David Murray in charge. Celtic were right at the bottom of the trough and about to have the Fergus McCann days going through. Were you even conscious of that disparity between the clubs, or were you just conscious of the fact that Rangers were successful and Celtic weren't? Was it?
No, I was, because I was thrown in the deep end. And by the time it came to a head with Fergus McCann and all that, I'd covered all of that in my own kind of haphazard, young journalist type way, because there was nobody else in the Sunday Times in Scotland doing it.
Mm-hmm.
It's remarkable to think of that now.
Yeah.
But, you know, the whole Celtic takeover, the whole McCann stuff, Rangers doing well in Europe at the time, I was covering all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And I was actually there the night of the famous night at Celtic Park.
Yeah.
Brian Dempsey outside the door. And I have seen this written before and people taking credit for it.
Mm-hmm.
But may God strike me down right now. But this is the truth. The journalists that day were in a kind of, that night, waiting for the deal to be done. We were in a kind of holding room.
Yeah.
And we were in there all day. And I remember at night time, came out, I'd be going on my way to the toilet or something. I came out of the door and I was just going, where's the toilet in this place? You know? And as I was standing outside the door, another door opened. And David White, the old Celtic director?
Chris White
came out. And Fergus McCann came out. And they were literally from as close as I am to you now.
Yep.
And there was a stairs right in front of me. And White said to Fergus McCann, "Good night, Fergus." And Fergus said to White, "Goodbye, Mr. White." And I have seen people taking credit for that in fanzines and stuff. There was only me there.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, even as a young fella who didn't know anything,
yeah.
I thought, wow, that's a moment.
Yeah.
And then I went in and Brian Dempsey came in and did an interview with him and I don't think I spoke to Fergus McCann that night because he was doing all sorts of other stuff. But I do remember that, yeah. It was very exciting, but it didn't get the full historic significance of it. But I did report on it quite a lot. I remember staying up, actually, that Friday, my deadline was Saturday morning. I stayed up to write that big story all through the night. Mm-hmm. Went back to Kinning Park, and I stayed up throughout the night writing that story.
In 22 years, it's such a different world now as to how you communicate.
Oh, yeah.
You'd have been sending texts to somebody or...
No, well, we had...
I'm talking about when you were outside the room.
Oh, yeah.
And that happened. You'd have tweeted that.
You'd have been tweeting it. You'd have been absolutely... In a second, you'd have tweeted it.
Yeah.
But we had... There was one office mobile phone then. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, Michael Douglas in Wall Street. It was one of those big brick things. One, and you have to put your name on the list to use this monstrosity of a thing. So that was it. There was no communication at all. There was no email.
Nope.
We had an internal messaging system, and it was amazing. And you think it's not that long ago.
No.
But the way the world has changed, and certainly the way the media has changed, even in the last 2 or 3 years, the way the media has changed is just unbelievable. You know,
and you were saying about you were aware of the importance of it, but perhaps didn't grasp the historical importance of it. Did perhaps everything that's happened with Rangers recently give a greater retrospective importance to you of what happened around the time of Fergus?
Maybe. I don't know. It's hard. I don't know if it's hard to compare the two, but I would look at them as very separate entities, you know. I know the Celtic. I do remember. I don't know. I just remember the anger. Working my way through into Celtic Park that day, just the anger of people. I just remember the anger. Mm-hmm. Remember the expressions on people's faces, and you know, I was like 24 or something, mm-hmm. something like that, ish. And you know. Of course, you know, it does resonate, the whole family dynasty and all that. And I was reading what everyone was writing because there was, you know, lots of guys were obviously way more clued in.
Yeah.
Were clued in. I would say way more, because I wasn't clued in at all. But I was reading their stuff and I was desperately, and I always had a hunger for information and trying to find out, hang on, what the hell, because I didn't want to embarrass myself, and I'm sure I did. Stuff that I'd written. I'd say if we're in the Twitter age then, and I was writing the stuff, I'm sure I would have been absolutely massacred. But I was always very much on McCann's side. I got on well with Brian in the lead up to all of that mm-hmm. takeover. I got on well with Brian Dempsey. I used to phone him a lot. McCann, I spoke to him the odd time. Bit intimidated by him, to mm-hmm. be honest with you. But I think even though I was a young fella, I recognised this guy was the business. He was the solution. And no messing about. Get in there, get the job done. And let everyone else to bugger off. Mm-hmm. Impressive.
Yeah.
Impressive.
You mentioned there about you being able to speak with Dempsey. Mm. This isn't a massive criticism. But it does appear as an outsider that Scottish media can be a bit cliquish with a group of people at the top and filtered down in some ways. You don't have to comment.
No, I mean...
Did you find it difficult then to did you feel like an outsider in that room in Celtic Park that day?
I didn't, because I was Balshi. I was a Balshi young fella. Mm-hmm. I didn't feel... intimidated by the journalists. Most of them were dead sound. There was kind of one guy that said something once that annoyed me. Mm-hmm. You know, that really did upset me, actually. And it wasn't about, you know, the quality of my work. It was about my nationality. But that was the only. Mm-hmm. And once I told other journalists about it, they kind of sorted it out pretty quickly. But I found them welcoming, mm-hmm. welcoming group. I didn't know the different agendas they might have had or the contacts that they had. I didn't know if, you know, I remember doing an interview with Liam Brady when he was a Celtic manager, and I was told beforehand, do you know he has he's a list in his drawer, he's a list of journalists who are pro-Celtic and anti-Celtic. I said, but you get out of it. He said, no. There's another journalist telling me this. I said, oh, no, I don't know. Look at that. Paranoid, that lot. Paranoid. Right, okay. So on I went, and of course, innocent as anything, I went in, Liam, what's in your drawer there? And he said, what do you mean? He said, is that where you keep the list of pro-Celtic journalists and anti-Celtic journalists? And he laughed, and he says, I've heard this. And, so I wrote, and this is a myth. And he opened up the drawer and said, look, honestly, I don't. So, you know, but when you're young like that, and you're due, you're coming in, and there's obviously all sorts, between the Celtic and the Rangers thing, there's all sorts of history of it. And certain journalists might be, you know, have a fondness for Celtic, and certain journalists might have a fondness for Rangers. I didn't know any of that. Mm-hmm. It took me a long time to figure it out. I wish I never had, to be honest. You know?
Yeah, but to be fair, I think most of us, the thing that frustrates us is most people who are going to write about football, getting back to the point you made earlier, if you can't do it, you might want to write about it. Which means you're probably going to be passionate about football, which means you're probably going to be a fan of a football team, which means in Scotland, you're more than likely, there's a 50% chance you're going to support, there's more than a 50% chance you're going to support one of Celtic and Rangers. And I think what frustrates us is when some people think we're thick and pretend that they're not supporters of that team. I don't value Graeme Spears' opinion any less or more because Graeme Spears grew up a Rangers fan. Probably value his opinion slightly more than I would do if he was pretending to be a St Mirren fan. Because at least I know he's being honest with me.
Yeah, I mean, but what difference does it make? Why should you be bothered by that?
No difference apart from the fact that they then pretend to be supporters of other teams. Don't do that nonsense.
Yeah, okay.
Don't pretend to be a St Mirren fan because you're not.
Why would you? Okay, why not just say, "Look, that's nonsense." Why is it an issue? Like, I mean, what's the why? Like, I mean, why would that upset you?
Because they then pretend to be supporters of other teams. Don't treat me like I'm an idiot.
Right.
Do what. I couldn't tell you what team you may or may not have supported prior to this conversation. Because you're not pretending to be. As I think the other thing that annoys everybody is. Because all the West of Scotland ones pretend to be St Mirren fans for some reason. They're not all from Paisley. Yeah, they're all St Mirren fans. Don't do that.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I know. You'd be talking about Chick Young would be one of these, right?
Yeah.
Now, I know the whole dynamic around that situation. Chick laughs about it. I'd say if Chick was to take it all personally, he wouldn't be around today. You know, he's a survivor, Chick. And I kind of see where you're coming from, but at the same time, I think, who cares? Why care about this? There's enough. There's more stuff to be worried about than that. Surely, I mean, I do understand where you're coming from.
But then, if you don't, if you pretend to be neutral, then, and I don't want to get you sucked into comment on other people, but there's one other person I can think of who, by pretending to be neutral, his obvious preference for one entity to take over at Rangers actually comes across as a bit embarrassing.
Well,
from a professional perspective.
Yeah, but I listen. I mean, I think Chick is great. I think Chick is ultimate.
I'm referring to somebody else.
All right, but I think Chick is a good guy, a really good guy, and we've clashed, we've disagreed hugely on the radio. Mm-hmm. You know, we've kicked lumps out of each other. Verbally speaking on the radio, but I still have a huge regard for Chick.
Yeah, and to be honest, I don't have a particular issue with Chick Young. I suppose things like when Chick Young was virtually throwing a party the day the draw was made, where Celtic and Rangers played each other in the League Cup semi-final, and was saying it's what every football fan in Scotland wants. That's the day I would prefer him to say, "Well, naturally, that's what I would prefer," because actually, I didn't know a single fee-paying customer of Scottish football who wanted that game. not one.
Yeah, well, listen, get Chick into the seat here alongside me. Next one, get Chick in, and he can answer for himself. And no better man. No well, better
sure,
man.
And I'm sure he would staunchly defend himself.
But he will tell you, you know, his view of things, and you might want to allow for like 2 or 3 hours. Do you know what I mean? But you know, you can ask me about anything, but I can't go out and say, oh, well, you know, this guy and that guy. I mean, I can't talk about it. Well, I'll absolutely defend myself. And people will say I'm biased this way, I'm biased that way.
Everybody's biased.
Yeah,
everybody's got a bias. You can't help it.
Yeah, it depends on what you mean by bias. People will say I'm anti-Celtic. People say I'm anti-Ranger. People say I'm anti-Hearts or Hibs. Listen, you can't express an
That's
opinion.
That's pretty much a maroon jumper you've got.
Yeah, it is a kind of maroon jumper. Yeah, I wore it deliberately to wind you up. You can't, if you're a journalist in Scotland and you're expressing an opinion, which I do, previously in the newspaper and now on the BBC, you're going to get flack.
Mm-hmm.
That's fine. People disagree all the time. What I don't get, what I find kind of a bit odd, is that now with the advent of social media and Twitter, more and more I find if I express an opinion on something, that if somebody disagrees with it, more and more people say that I'm biased or that I'm trolling or that I'm fishing, looking for attention. I'm just expressing my opinion. Now, I might have got it wrong, I might have got it right, but I never go out deliberately and say, my life is not that sad that I sit in front of my computer and go, God, I'm desperate for a bit of attention. I think I'd go onto Twitter and wind people up. If it comes across that way, fine, I can't help what people think, but this is my view, and it's there to be agreed with or disagreed with, and I do engage with people on Twitter. Quite a lot. But I'm not trolling.
But you know, I think to some extent, Twitter, I think, is great for creating that engagement.
It is. It can be, yeah.
It can be great for creating the engagement between... I think it can help, to be fair to the STV guys.
Mm.
I think the STV guys at times have been very good at engaging with supporters on Twitter. And I do have sympathy that you then have Diddy's.
Mm-hmm.
I think possibly part of the problem is 140 characters forces a truncation of an opinion that, you know, if I was to comment on your jumper in real life, you might think to yourself, right, okay, how do I word that I don't like Tom's jumper?
Mm.
Whereas if I've only got 140 characters to say that I don't like your jumper, I have to then say, your jumper's a nonsense, I don't like it.
Mm.
So I think that it's the nature of the medium. It compounds the problem. And I'm going to be a bit critical of myself here. The namelessness of people.
Mm.
I mean, Harry Brady's not my real name.
You're not. It's not your real name.
No.
It's not the name on the door.
It's not the name on the door. No, I'm David Murray.
Sir David Murray, excuse me.
Yes.
Excuse me. Stop it right there.
The £100 million is in the corner. The namelessness, the anonymity of Twitter also encourages people's thinking that they can then be abusive and critical.
Does. Now listen, I mean, I wouldn't, if I was bothered by this, I wouldn't be on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
I do have a thick skin, so it doesn't really bother me. But it does kind of make me, kind of scratch my head sometimes and thinking, God, there's a lot of sad people out there.
But the other thing, I mean, you find this to a much greater extent. I find this to a minor degree, so I can only multiply that up a million times for you guys. We get 5,000-6,000 downloads for a podcast.
Do you? Wow, that's brilliant.
And 4 people come on and say it's good.
Mm.
And 3 people come on and say it's bad.
Mm.
And you might answer the 3 people. You might just say thanks to the 4 people who say it's good. And you might answer the people who've said it's bad.
Mm.
But that might then involve them answering back. And you answering back again. Mm, you answer. Mm. So you have a 20-tweet interaction with those 3 people. At the end of that, you feel like the whole world is telling you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
When I say it's only three people.
Absolutely. And we all of us have to remember that when you're under siege on Twitter, a siege could amount to like 50 people. Mm-hmm. But that's not a siege. It seems like it sometimes. Yeah. When you're on Twitter and you go, oh my God, another one giving it to me, another one. But really, it's an unreal world. And some of the issues, and I've had it, and I won't say what the issues are, I've had it with a lot of different clubs. I had one relatively recently with Celtic, where it felt to me like an awful lot of Celtic people disagreed with me on a certain issue. Mm-hmm. But really, it wasn't like that at all. You know, because I went to speak to my mates, and I say to them, you know, what do you think about this? And they'll say, I haven't even thought about that. You know, you have to remember that it can be a bit of a kind of parallel universe on Twitter, yeah, where the opinions of 50 people, as you know, their opinion is as valid as mine. It can seem like a greater thing when it actually isn't, you know. Uh-huh. You can extrapolate way too much from the opinions of 20, 30, 40, 50 people on Twitter and assume, oh my God, this is what the Celtic fans think.
We speaking on this podcast a few years ago with somebody else that used to do it, and we were talking about the fact that Sporters Busmeister used to have three diddies at the back of the bus who had a different opinion to the other 47 people on the bus. And they were the three diddies at the back of the bus. But now those three diddies speak to the three diddies in the other bus and speak to the... And out of 100 supporters' buses, you've now got 300 people.
Yeah, yeah.
But you've got 4,500 people who disagree with those people.
Yeah.
But those 300 people now have an accumulation to their vocal dislike of anything.
And it's all about opinions. And I absolutely... And I know some... And maybe with good reason, some football fans out there think that journalists are, we think that we're the font of all knowledge. Mm-hmm. I don't believe I'm the font of all knowledge. Some of the reason why I'm on Twitter is to find out what fans are thinking, what they're saying. I wouldn't like to think of myself as arrogant or detached. And that's another reason why I'm on Twitter. And I don't know it all, you know what I mean? Sometimes I know very little. But that's something that's thrown at you as well, you know, arrogant, pompous. And I genuinely don't believe I am. You know?
But to be fair to you and this, and probably people listen to, some people listen to this will criticise me because I'm, you know. Yeah. To defend to you and lots of other journalists, you probably get tarred, and again, you don't have to speak about this, you probably get tarred with the Daily Record brush. In that when the Daily Record creates itself as the story around Rangers' takeover with Dave King and it being locked out the door, and that actually makes itself the story and almost writes an article about the Daily Record being the story, that then, the Daily Record being the biggest selling newspaper, is what then colours people's opinions. So that, you know, I had a debate with Stephen McGowan of the Daily Mail on Twitter, where I'd written a piece having a go at journalists. To be fair, in the piece I specifically identified Daily Record and Sun newspaper, not individuals, just the people who write for those papers. But he was a bit critical because I was implying that it was all journalists.
Mm. Yeah, I think you'll find the journalists will get touchy about that when there's a generalisation or a perception of the Scottish mainstream media. That's the one that's...
Yeah.
You know, that's my old the old Twitter bingo. You know, that's SMSM.
Yeah,
is in there with sweep and all these other hit and the hit parade, and there will be, you know, and I'd be one of them. I would think that generalising about the Scottish mainstream media is a bit ridiculous, because that's to assume that everybody is the same. I don't think that's the case at all.
No, and deep down we don't, but there's a vocal minority of journalists who then, well, it's like people doing all walks of life, you then generalize.
But they're there to be disagreed with.
Yeah.
You know, they're there to be disagreed with, and that's
I suppose, so you mentioned Chip Young. Well, an example of that would be Jim Traynor. in the famous Chick Young and Jim Trina fallout.
Oh, yeah. Which one?
Well, the one about, well, you're either, the one where Roddy Forsyth was called in and then patently just obviously...
But this was nodding, someone was nodding.
No, yeah, Alistair Johnson. Where Jim Trina...
Minutes from going out of business,
yeah,
or something.
Where it was fairly obvious to me that Roddy Forsyth thought, I can't be bothered with this, and had left the programme.
Yeah.
But Jim Trina more or less said, but I'm saying that's not the case, and because I'm Jim Trina, I'm right. Mm. And Raman Bhardwaj and Roddy Forsyth and you, Chick Young, you're not as elevated as me. Mm. It's that sort of tone that then gets people...
Or is that what you're reading into it? Because you're not a fan of Jim Trainor.
Well, it came across that way.
Yeah, but maybe it did.
Yeah.
Maybe it did. But I think I think people do have preconceived notions about journalists, and maybe with good reason, but they have their firm view that Tom English is this, Chick Young is that, and whoever else is the other. And there's not a lot that you can do to disabuse them of that. I remember once there was a week where I wrote two columns, both of them about, in the Scotsman, both of them about Celtic, two completely different subjects. The first one was something that Celtic had done well, and it was a complimentary piece about Celtic. Second one, something happened that week, which I think reflected badly on Celtic, and I wrote that column, which was a column that was critical of Celtic. And I got reaction, not a massive reaction, but the reaction was that I was all over the place on Celtic, that I wasn't consistent, and, you know, a joke. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm going to say, hang on, that. These are two completely different subjects. Can I not hold one opinion on this subject and a different opinion on this completely different subject? But because it didn't conform to what some football fans thought that I was, you know, mm-hmm. I should be one thing or the other. I don't know. I still, to be honest with you, I'm still trying to, all these years later, the psyche of some Scottish football fans is still a bit of a mystery to me. A lot of the kind of prejudice, maybe prejudice is the wrong word, but attitude towards the Scottish media, I think, became deep rooted long before I ever came to Scotland.
Yeah,
you know, I think that's maybe part of the issue. I don't really sometimes understand the depth of feeling, because this stuff is rooted in history, mm-hmm. that I wasn't here to witness.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
And I do get that. I kind of don't understand the history, but I understand that certain views on all sides, mm-hmm. They're holding opinions based on stuff that happened way before I darkened Scotland's door.
Well, it will be they don't change their spots. That's what they're deep down. That's what they like, no turn against us. And I suppose it's also, which I suppose one of the things to touch on as well, is one of my great frustrations, and I would blame the game as much, you know, as much as everybody connected with the game. The crap TV contracts and media contracts that Scottish football's got.
Well, you're talking about these last night on the radio.
Yeah, and I was listening to it this morning. Your comments. Before I get into that, actually... Mm. The chap from Alloa,
Mike Mulroney, you're talking about.
He's on the board of the SPFL.
He is.
So the SPFL board's fully behind Neil Doncaster then. Because he was doing everything he could to not criticise Neil Doncaster.
Yeah. I'd agree with that assessment. That he was doing everything he could not to criticise Neil Doncaster.
Yeah. Even to... No, when you asked him a question... Slightly rewording the question to answer a different question. But the intrinsic point that he was then trying to get, all the root cause of all those problems is actually a bad TV contract.
Yeah, listen, I think that's one issue, and the TV contracts are terrible, right? Now I've heard it from a couple of different sources. And it was interesting that last on the radio, Mike Mulroney didn't deny it when I put it to him that the playoff games for the next 3 years, so that's 6 times 3, that's 18 games, contracted to BT for a combined £550,000. Not per year, for the 3 years. Now, I've had it from a couple of sources. I was happy enough with it to go on it with radio on radio. When I put it to Mike Mulroney, who's on the SPFL board, who should know these things, he didn't deny it. So I just think that alone is mind blowing. The Premiership contract is dreadfully poor, and yeah, and at the inconvenience, not even inconvenience, it's way more than that. The way football fans, and I'm getting hotter on this topic. I think I was probably a bit slow out of the blocks in terms of understanding the frustrations of football fans. It's only in the last number of years that I've really got in tune with the way football fans in this country are messed about.
What other fans in the UK have attended 4 league games, home or away, at 3 o'clock on a Saturday?
Yeah, I know. That's Celtic. Celtic's only 4 at 3 o'clock on a Saturday, all season.
Yeah.
That is...
And now I accept that some of those are because we mucked up in the Champions League qualifications.
Yeah, that would be part of it, but doesn't explain at all, by no means.
And that's because every one of our games, because we are the cash cow of Scottish football, which... we're the cash cow of Scottish football. Mm. We are milked by everybody to fund the game. Would be my argument.
Yeah, well, I know. That would be your argument.
Don't get me wrong. The game can't... We don't have a game if everybody else doesn't exist and there's a quid pro quo.
Yeah, that sounds a bit like the old Rangers kind of... You know, the Rangers supremacy, you know? We're the cash cow. You can't survive without us, lads.
No. I'm not saying they can't survive.
I'm trolling.
But, so for example, there's a weight of sympathy behind Inverness fans about the ridiculous nature of Inverness having to be in Glasgow on Sunday or at 12 o'clock.
Yeah.
But I never see the same weight of sympathy for Celtic fans that we permanently are going up to Dingwall and Inverness on Saturday mornings and Sunday mornings.
Yeah.
Because we're just expected, because we will turn up. And we'll put money in the door, and we'll bring in the TV contract. That's what I mean by the cash cow.
No, I get that point, yeah. I do get that
point. To then play 4 games, that then causes a problem, because there's no reliability to your season book purchase as to when you'll get to play, go to a game. You've got, I remember 2 years ago, Celtic giving a stat that up to 7,000 people came from Ireland to every home game at Celtic Park. Mm. So that's 7,000 people who can't leave it to 14 days in advance to make the travel arrangements to then get mucked about.
Correct.
And I think if you, online, the general sense of what I was getting from people was, we put up with getting mucked about if the TV contract was worth it.
Yeah.
But we're not even getting a decent TV contract. I mean, my point is, average viewing figures for Scottish... Now, I had this debate with Peter Lawwell, who tried to ignore it. Average viewing figures for Scottish football are better than rugby league. But rugby league gets a better TV contract. Why? Because rugby league moved to the summer to give Sky their football demographic during the summer. Now, I'm not saying Scottish football has to move to a summer timetable, but can somebody please do the research of what would be the economic impact of Scottish football moving to a summer timetable to see whether it was sufficiently justifiable to have that TV contract?
This is a common thread, and if you're a representative, a fans rep from every club in the country in here, they'd all talk about similar stuff. You all have your own legitimate reasons to feel disillusioned with the way the game has been run. No question about it. But nothing changes.
Well, can
the SPFL are the clubs, you know? So Doncaster gets it in the neck, rightly so. Mm-hmm. But really, Doncaster is doing the club's bidding for them. So So it's everybody is to blame. All of the clubs are to blame for this. The clubs get the administration they deserve. The people who are suffering are the fans. They're being messed about. It's ultimately... Neil Doncaster is there as a kind of human punchback. Mm-hmm. That's the reason he gets paid $200,000. He gets punched so that Peter Lawwell and Duncan Fraser and the rest of them don't get punched. That's his raison d'etre. But really, the people running the game are Peter Lawwell, Duncan Fraser, all the chairman, all the chief executives. Ultimately, it's their fault.
The TV contract has been negotiated by people who had weakened their own bargaining position by running the game down before they, just before they walked into the negotiations. Mm. Mm. Well, that's just ridiculous. Mm.
Now, listen, you're not going to get anything contradictory from me out of that.
I praised STV on here. Mm. We have a domestic commercial broadcaster who only takes from the game and doesn't put money into the game. We have a paid-for, license-fee-driven broadcaster who takes Scottish, if you were to do it on a pro-rata basis, takes the Scottish sport allocation to prop up highlights packages for the English League and then broadcast them nationally so that I'm driving to something at a Scottish football ground and I'm being, and there's a big game on in Scotland the next night. And I'm being told only about the big game on it that's on in England the next night on 5Live. Because that's a national broadcast.
Well, that's what Radio Scotland is for.
Yeah, but Radio Scotland gives me an hour of dedicated sports coverage.
Every night, but it also gives you, like, on a Friday, Saturday and Sunday, it gives you, like, 5 hours a day.
Yes.
You know, I mean,
but
pretty much.
Where's our decent highlights package? Where's our live coverage? Where's BBC... BBC on a pro, if they got the money on a pro rata basis that the national that they get for English football, they could beat Sky to national team to live coverage of Scottish football.
Yeah, listen, I don't know. I obviously don't operate at that level.
I mean, for me, the simple thing that
it would be lovely to see it.
The simple thing Scottish football could do to go in with a strong hand to the negotiation with Sky. Say, here's the deal we want, and if we don't get it, we're moving our scheduled kickoff time to 3 o'clock on a Sunday. Because if they move to 3 o'clock on a Sunday, it just stuffs Sky's coverage of English football.
I think you've got a very sound point. I completely agree. The TV contracts were terrible. They're totally undersold. I'm not saying Scottish football is of a great standard, but it's got to be worth more. You put a good negotiator in there. I don't think Scottish football's negotiators have been particularly impressive. Sorry to say, Peter Law was one of them.
And he has more or less said to Celtic fans, he's waiting for the bus. He's waiting for the English football bus.
Yeah, he can wait all he likes.
Correct. If he thinks that the cure is English football, the problem is the patient could be dead by the time the cure is invented. He's waiting for English football, so as a consequence, he's told me to my face that Celtic would win a case against Sky for the uncompetitive TV contracts that they run, because they shouldn't be showing English football in Scotland without paying a fee to Scottish football, because that's how TV rights work throughout the rest of Europe. Okay. We'd win it. He could go into Sky and say, give us this better contract, or we're moving the protected time that you get to 3 o'clock on a Sunday. We'll move it. And you can't do anything about it, because that would stuff up hours of English football on a Sunday. Mm-hmm. He could do all of that, but he doesn't want to annoy Sky, because Sky's the only thing that might one day turn around and say, come on, Celtic, come on, Dave.
It's a very interesting...
And that's very naive.
Yeah, I can't see it. I cannot see it. I don't think there's any will. I mean, ever since I've been in Scotland, and I would imagine a long time before, Celtic and Rangers have been talking about it, although mostly Celtic, actually. Rangers kind of... Well, David Murray kind of gave up on this idea of moving to England. Celtic seemed to hanging on for grim death to this notion that they could go to England. There's no appetite for Celtic or Rangers in England. It just doesn't exist. Scudamore, the chief executive, said anytime he's asked about it, he kind of throws his eyes up to heaven and goes, not this again. Never say never.
A 60,000 seat stadium that you could probably fill, you could probably knock down the main stand, turn to 80,000, mm-hmm. would be filled every week within the Premiership.
Yeah.
So why would all bar one or two teams vote for Celtic to come in to Premiership? Because all we're doing is, within 5 years, every one of those clubs who voted for Celtic to go in would be one step further away from Champions League football, because there's a big behemoth up north that can fill 80,000 seats.
Absolutely. I mean, if you throw Celtic, now, professionally, it would be great. I would love to see Celtic, professionally. Selfishly, I'd like to see Celtic playing against the top teams in England. Great crack.
Yeah.
It would destroy the Scottish game. I have a suspicion as well that it might destroy the fabric of Celtic football. When you get, obviously, if say hypothetically, they go in, next season, they're in the Premiership. Right, now what would Celtic's ambition be? First of all, to survive for the first few years, stabilise, then move up. Ultimately, Champions League. Mm-hmm. That's where.
Yeah.
Now, they would have to bust the wage structure.
Mm-hmm.
They would have to go monstrously in debt, or have an Abramovich, have a Sheikh Mansour running the show completely. I think the fabric of the club, you look at what happened to Man United, the fans, they tolerated because Man United have had some good times under Alex Ferguson. But it's an uneasy tolerance because they know the Glazers. If Sheikh Mansour ever leaves Man City, what on earth would happen to Man City? Abramovich, they're in the throes, they're in the grip of one man. Like Rangers were in the grip of one man. I don't think that's a healthy scenario. And I just, unless Celtic could reinvent themselves as a Bayern Munich or something, mm-hmm. then great. But I think to compete for the Champions League, which is what Celtic, a club of Celtic size, could do, would want to do, I think the whole ethos of the club would really have to change. And I'm not sure that's an altogether appealing prospect.
And I agree to some extent, because at the moment you're reliant upon a benevolent dictatorship to see you through that, and then you get a Diddy in charge and you go and you get liquidated.
Mm-hmm.
But the contrary to that, I actually think Celtic leaving Scottish football could change to summer football and would do all right.
Yeah, I disagree with that, and I know why you're saying it, because it does kind of suit the argument. We'll leave and you'll be fine, honestly. But I don't think they'd be fine.
But if you're a Motherwell fan at the moment,
yeah,
you never have.
What would the TV deal be like? I mean, it's rubbish now with Celtic in the league. What would it be like if Celtic were down the road playing in England?
But you cut your cloth accordingly, you find your right level, and you play a different time of year. And already Scottish football out with, I mean, people make comments about, oh, for 10 years, for X years. For 25 years, every team out with Celtic and Rangers has been an embarrassment in European football for Scotland. For 25 years. Getting knocked out by teams from nowhere.
Mm.
Well, that's not going to change. But the competitive nature, I mean, I've spoken to fans of other clubs who, yes, it's changed from a two-horse league to a one-horse league. But actually,
well, one and a half. I mean, come on, let's give Aberdeen some credit here.
Yeah, but apart from outside Aberdeen, who genuinely believed at any point that...
Oh, no, absolutely.
Yeah.
But
no, Aberdeen, I'm giving credit to Aberdeen.
Well,
yeah. and what that's demonstrated is when Aberdeen actually... It took 20 years for Aberdeen to recover from trying to compete with the speculate to accumulate culture that they did for just 2 to 3 years when you were at the Sunday Times.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now they've recovered from that. Actually, they're doing all right.
Aberdeen are in decent shape.
And what yeah. what I'm hearing to do with the stuff that's been happening. Rangers are in a straitjacket and a padded cell somewhere in the moment. And I think Hibs and Hearts are positioning themselves that they can see themselves being Hibs, Hearts and Aberdeen just sitting behind Celtic.
Yeah, I think Hearts, I've been hugely impressed with what Hearts have been doing. Since they plunged into administration, which, I mean, the disgrace of that, the embarrassment of it, but ever since the change in administration, the foundation of Hearts, hugely impressive. And Budge, hugely impressive. That whole club that has a vision, mm-hmm. to make a good decision after good decision. Yeah. It's the kind of template to recover. This is how you recover. When you fall so low, this is how you do it to get back. And I think Hearts are a credit, actually. You know, I think, and you know, I still have that image in my head of Hearts, and they're probably the lowest point when Romanov was holding the gun to the head and saying, "Give us your money, or else you might close down." And this little kid, remember this, the little child of about 7 or 8 or 9, right, yeah. comes in with his piggy bank, mm-hmm. And hands it into the office. And I thought that image was okay. Stop that image. That is the moment. The Hearts have reached rock bottom. You compare that moment, that snapshot in their history, to what they are now, mm-hmm. to complete revolution that's happened there in a very, very short space of time. Very heartening, if you like, to see it. Mm-hmm. Now, that's a club that's on the up. It's a good news story. Hibs are beginning to try and get it together a bit.
But I can just sense in the statements in the last, there's a positioning going on.
Oh, no, of course there is. Yeah, yeah.
To be.
Yeah, yeah. And
we're going to be back up there in the decision-making process, and there'll be there's four of us.
No, there's no doubt about it. They've got plans. You know, they want to be relevant again.
But I genuinely think, take Celtic out of that, and you would have a competitive environment where fans would enjoy going to watch football.
Yeah, you might. You will. You would have a competitive league. You would have no media attention. You would have no TV revenue to speak of. So you'll be talking about, in a period of time, you're talking about semi-pro. That's what you'd end up.
But that's why I'd move it to the summer.
Well, yeah.
Because you move it to the summer, because Scotland's biggest problem is we are right next door to England and share the same language.
Mm. Yeah. Move it to the summer. Would it make a difference? It might. A, it's hypothetical. I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon. B, I think Celtic should be not talking so much about leaving Scottish football, but trying to make Scottish football
well,
better.
And this is
one. Make it better.
You talked about the people running the game are there by the clubs, and this is my biggest criticism of people talking your game down, of that whole Armageddon thing. Mm-hmm. So I know. The lowest figure I can find is every house built in the UK generates 2.75 permanent jobs. You can actually get statistics up to 6. Mm-hmm. Every pound spent on construction in the UK generates £2.84 for GDP. Mm-hmm. Those stats. So I contacted the SFA and asked what was the equivalent of football. Mm-hmm. And I was told, well, first of all, I was ignored by the first two people, so I eventually went to Stuart Regan and asked that question. Mm-hmm. We don't collect that type of information. Well, two things. How can you be the governing body that positively and proactively advocates on behalf of the sport if you don't know any of that information? And two, how can you talk about Armageddon if you don't know what the base position is to then have an Armageddon fall from?
Yeah.
Well, the statistics I have been able to find and cobble together myself, Glasgow, just by having Celtic, Rangers, Partick Thistle and Scotland play in it, the Glasgow economy is £70 million better off because of football.
Right, well, you got the numbers.
So why
big numbers.
Do we not talk positively about our game? Why are we not talking up? Why are we not, instead of getting the Offensive Behaviour Act imposed upon on football, they should be kicking the door down and saying, you can stick that up your jacksie, because this is what we want from you, because this is what we generate for your economy.
I agree, and too often that argument about why aren't we talking up Scottish football is dumped at the door of the media.
It's the game.
Now, the media dedicates hour upon hour of radio, the game, hour upon hour of television, really, the game, maybe less so, obviously less so than radio, but page after page after page in newspapers on the game. There is no country, and I have travelled around the world with my job, very lucky to do it, apart from maybe Italy, France, and Brazil. I don't think I have ever seen a country in any country in the world that dedicates as much newspaper coverage to football as we have in Scotland. It is astonishing. It is astonishing. It was one of the first things that I noticed when I moved back here in 2005. And it seems to be that the more the standard of Scottish football drops, the more pages that are dedicated to it. Mm-hmm. If you go back when I was here first from 92 to 96, there was much less coverage when Rangers were doing good things in Europe. But it's an extraordinary thing. I mean, you go back there. I mean, I used to write maybe a couple for the Sunday paper, a couple of stories, a couple of pieces. Now it's like page after page, spread after spread. Yet the standard is much lower. I mean, and if that's not talking up the game, of course some of the coverage is critical. It has to be. But a lot of it is reporting, say, Celtic the other night, terrific second half performance against Kilmarnock, the Ronnie Roar, all of that stuff, Lee Griffiths posing on the back page with a match ball, all positive stuff. Mm-hmm. The media cannot, this accusation cannot be levelled at the media that we talk it down. Occasionally, maybe doing columns, I've done it myself, when a match is rubbish or the administration is rubbish. But by and large, the coverage, it's massively positive for the game. I don't think the media gets anything like the credit it deserves. The people who are at fault are the people running the game. And the people who run the game are the clubs. And they have the cheek, some of them, to turn around and say, you're talking the game down to the media. Excuse me, you're the one who's done this ridiculous TV deal. You know, I don't get it sometimes.
But from my perspective, I suppose, I would say there's a lot of very similar content. You say there's more and more content.
There is a lot of similar content.
So, for example, you would go to Spain and you might have a double page spread that talking of the second half on Wednesday night. That would talk, would be a double page spread about the fact that Ronnie Dyla changed from 4-2-3-1 to 4-4-2. And then exactly how that impacted in the game. I would actually argue that it wasn't specifically the 4-4-2. It was Kilmarnock that then thought they could win the game after scoring and stopped. My brother couldn't make it. My nephew was playing football and he was at the game. And I texted him at half-time saying this whole game's being played between 30 yards and 12 yards of Kilmarnock's goal. Kilmarnock went up the park. Even after he scored, they still hadn't had a player in the box, in Celtic's box with the ball.
And they got spooked by scoring.
Yeah. And suddenly they opened up.
Celtic hadn't had a shot on target up to that.
No.
Now, they had all the ball. The two Kilmarnock centre halves were playing really, really well, looked very comfortable in the match. But very impressive. Soon as they went one down, it was a collective, right, lads, come on, let's up our game here. And a good substitution, Griffiths coming on, very good finishes from him. But that was impressive. And that was all spoken about. You said it on the radio, tactical changes, whether you think it was responsible for it or not, it was spoken about written about in the newspapers. So I'd be very supportive of the media in this country. Of course, people are going to write ridiculous things. God knows I've written them myself, and will continue to write them. But by and large, I think Scottish football, and just to touch on what you said, maybe it's too much. Maybe there's too much of it written. Mm-hmm. I mean, I get contacted by people from different clubs, smaller clubs. That, oh, we don't get a crack at it. Yeah, do. You look at across the sweep of the coverage, particularly in the tabloid. Like everyone gets a fair crack.
But then is that not partly down to them in that they're not giving you something to write about? So, for example, you have the Alloa guy on, because Allah were doing things that make them newsworthy, that then makes the guy a regular contact, which then makes him somebody that you will go and speak to because he's an SPFL board member who might actually speak because that's the type of person.
Yeah, Mike Mulroney's on the radio quite a lot. I think an awful lot of clubs get a fair crack. People might disagree with me, but that's my perception. That is my view. I might be wrong, but that's reading it, and I buy 5 or 6 newspapers every day, and that's my view. There to be disagreed with on all things.
So I've kept you long enough, and just notice on the time. One thing I would like to see: how do you see journalism changing? Because obviously you've been a newspaper man.
Yeah.
Now you're a radio man. Newspaper sales are falling.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And obviously there's much more people talk about, there's much more fan media and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So how do you see your job in 5-10 years' time?
I don't know. If we continue at the rate of change that we're currently going at, it's really hard to predict what's coming next. Twitter has changed the game completely. First of all, you had newspapers. Then you had newspapers giving away their content online.
Mm-hmm.
They're not content to do that anymore. What they want to do now is they want to give it to you online for free, most of them, earlier than they've ever given it to you.
Mm-hmm.
So you now don't have to log on to Scotsman.com or Herald.com or Telegraph or whatever. If you follow them on Twitter, they will hand deliver it to you. They will put it under your nose. All you've got to do is click the link, and there's the stuff. And it's there. Could be 10, 15 minutes. If you look at Henry Winter in the Telegraph, Henry will have finished his match report, like we all do, maybe 5 minutes after the final whistle. Maybe after 10 minutes after the final whistle, or 15 minutes after the final whistle, Telegraph Twitter, up pops Henry's. Some people won't have left the stadium, and yet there's the match report. That's how the game has changed. Everything has become immediate. Even a few short years ago, you'd have to wait until tomorrow for the paper. Now, you don't have to wait to get to the car park. Sometimes, to get the stuff. And that's how the game has changed massively. That's why newspapers, some are commercialising it. Telegraph are doing well. The Times in Scotland are doing well. They've signed some good journalists. They're making their websites work. Others less so. I think newspapers are going to struggle. Sadly, my own newspaper, The Scotsman, my old newspaper, The Scotsman, in Scotland and Sunday, struggling, Herald struggling, they don't have the big budgets. But there will always be a need for journalism. It's just a different form.
Mm-hmm.
It'll go online. Will The Scotsman and The Herald go digital only one day? Possibly. But there'll always be journalism.
Yeah.
It'll just be digital journalism. That's where we're at. It'll be desperately sorry. I'll be desperately sorry if that day comes. Because they were talking about newspapers that are like hundreds of years old. Unfortunately, for some fans who hate us, we'll always be around in some shape or form, maybe digitally, if not in print. We're not going away, but certainly newspapers are bleeding. There's no question they're bleeding. And they're trying to find a way of changing the business model so that digital revenues in some way make up the falling advertising and the falling circulation. That's a massive challenge.
And since this is a Celtic podcast, I'll ask one. Could you see Celtic's next season with Ronnie Dyla going to lose 2 centre-halves, probably?
Yeah, you might do. If I was Jason Denier's agent, I'd be telling him, sign up for Celtic for another season.
Yeah.
You're going great. You're in the team. You're going to be playing in Europe. You're becoming, at such a young age, a senior player in the team. Everything is going well. Why would you change that? He's not going to get in the City team when he goes down there.
Because they'll go and sign.
They'll go and sign.
They'll get a new manager in, Klopp or whatever, and they'll go and sign.
They'll go and sign. They'll go and sign. There'll be a big turnaround there in the summer. I'm not sure that will happen. I think in the interest of the player, I think it would be in the best interest of the player. Van Dijk, you'd have to say, would probably go. There could be turnover there. Johansson might be targeted. He's been very, very good. Initially, I wasn't too sold on Ronnie Dyla. The European kind of nonsense at the start, the bad results. Warming to him as he goes along, enjoying his team playing.
Mm-hmm. How is he in with the media?
He's very good. He's very good, yeah. Very, very good. Brave.
What strikes me is he seems to be just honest.
Yeah, he's honest. He is, no question. There was funny, there was one after the St. Johnstone match, actually. One at Celtic Park. And there was a journalist over from Holland. And Guidetti started on the bench that night, I think. I think he was on the bench. Certainly didn't start the match. Because the question that Dyla was asked was by this journalist, why was John Guidetti not in the team? And Dyla, like that, says, because he's not good enough. Brilliant. You know, no soft soap.
Yeah.
No PR. Direct. To the point. What more could you ask for as a journalist when you feel that a manager is telling you the truth? I think that's great. So I've been impressed with him. There's a treble there to be played for. I think they'll be better in Europe next season. Mm-hmm. I like Mackay Stephen. I like Armstrong. I'm a huge fan of Commons. Johansson has been excellent. Griffiths has done his stuff.
You thought Skepovic was going to work?
I thought Skepovic was going to work. I wouldn't entirely give up hope on him yet. I thought he had pedigree. I thought that was a signing that would work. I wouldn't give up hope yet for him.
He seems to be ditched.
He does seem to be ditched, yeah.
I mean, if he goes in the summer, you would say, well, round about January, you spotted the Dyla giving up on him.
Yeah, he seems to have. But I looked at his track record, and I thought, gosh, this guy could be a bit of a coup here, you know. But it hasn't worked out, and sometimes it doesn't. But he's done okay elsewhere. You know, the two Dundee United boys, I think, are going to be terrific players for Celtic. Johansson, the more I see of him. Now that he's playing, earlier on the season, he was playing in a more defensive midfield role. I didn't like him in that position. Didn't think he played more of a defensive midfield. You see him now, and he's got presence. He's a bit of a leader. Mm-hmm. I like him. I like him a lot. I like Denier. I almost like Denier more than I like Van Dijk.
Van Dijk switches off for me.
Yeah,
just a half second.
Just a half at the top level in the Premiership. 9 times out of 10, he'll stroll through games. He'll look his most graceful defender. You know, you've ever seen, and he'll look majestic. He'll look like an Adonis at the back.
Yeah.
But you put him up against Salzburg, Inter Milan, and you know, some of the European games, Legia Warsaw, and his anticipation of danger around him isn't what it should be for a player who has the reputation that he has. He's still very young.
The Inter goal where I was in the north stand, so I thought Gordon had made a save, parried out, and they'd scored. Mm. Obviously, from the south stand, you would have seen that he should have let it go.
Yeah.
But actually, the Inter player starts behind Van Dijk and runs past Van Dijk.
He does, yeah.
Who scores, and he switched off. There was another couple of goals in Europe where, at the time, you thought another defender had made the mistake. Then when you saw the replay, you actually saw Van Dijk played them onside by switching off.
There's one or two times in Europe where Effie Ambrose has got collared.
Yeah.
But really, when you look at it again, Legia Warsaw, the first one, the first leg, I think, was an example where Van Dijk was caught out. Who else did they play? Who else did they play in Europe? And another couple of games, Salzburg, I think, was one of them. And Maribor was another one. Where you just think, you know what, Van Dijk does things that great defenders do, but he also does things that great defenders would never do. Mm-hmm. But I have to add to that he is young.
Yeah.
And if you put him into a decent Premiership team, he could train on very easily. I think they'll get plenty of money for him when he goes. And again, that does feel, well, I'm blowing smoke here. The whole model, Celtic model, is as it should be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I haven't even mentioned Craig Gordon, who's my player of the year.
I think he'll stay forever.
I think he probably will. I think he's had his adventure down in England.
Yeah.
I think he's such an impressive guy, not just a goalkeeper, as a person. He's a very impressive bloke. I think he realises how good he has it now. Mm-hmm. He's so good to be so close to kind of the end, if you like, although he would never have thought it was going to be the end, but a lot of us thought it was the end of him.
Yeah.
To go to that kind of dark place, if you like, and to revitalise his career in such an amazing way. His performance, okay, the home leg against Inter Milan aside, they would never have got the home leg against Inter Milan if he wasn't so good in the earlier rounds. I think Craig Gordon has been absolutely magnificent. So you look at those, you know, Gordon and Denier, Kai Stephen, Johansson, Armstrong. I think there's a good Scott Brown. I think there's a really good nucleus there. Mm-hmm. I think what Celtic are still missing a striker. Someone who, you know, like what Skepovic was supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
Griffiths is good, but you need more than Griffiths.
Yeah.
Stokes looks to be fading out of the picture. Goodetti would probably leave, probably not worth retaining anyway.
Mm-hmm. He also, in the same way that it looks like Dyla gave up on Skepovic, it looks like around about Christmas time, Goodetti decided he wasn't.
Yeah. Staying. And I, you know what, I like that. I see that as strong management. From Dyla. Here's a guy, Goodetti, who's been in the papers, clearly scouting around, looking for another place to be. And Dyla said, no, sir. We're not having that. Have a few weeks in the subs.
Mm-hmm.
And I like that. That's strong management. Because the team kept on winning anyway.
Yeah.
You know, if the team lost, then Dyla has got a problem. But when you get Goodetti out of the team, maybe to teach him some manners, and the team keeps on winning without him, that's a win-win for Ronnie Dyla.
So you think he's got it, Dyla?
Yeah. I said at the time that it was an educated punt. It was a good time to do it, and you mentioned it earlier on. It was a good time to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And if it didn't work out, well, they could replace him. And no harm done, because we're going to win the league anyway. But I think it has worked out. And I can definitely see, I mean, I think the whole Ronnie Roar thing is a bit overblown and it's a bit of nonsense. That's me being...
That's marketing. I think he's switched on enough to know. He's only doing it as marketing.
It is. I mean, I look at it and I go, oh, God, you've just beaten St. Mirren and you're jumping around the stadium. But it is connecting himself with the fans.
Because I've just paid 20-odd quid...
No,
I don't want a manager who says, you know what, celebrating winning this game's beneath me.
I get it. I completely get it. Sorry, I mean, I'm just being a cynical... I'm being a cynical old hack there. I completely get it, and the fans love it, and it does create the bond between the manager and the fans, and that's all good. And I think he's done very well. If he pulls off the treble... That's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
Now, if Rangers ever come back, and there's a real contender there with money, money and support behind them, then it'll be an interesting test. But that day might be.
I was just going to say he may be managing Real Madrid at that point.
He might be. He might be. 6 feet under, but that's good. Yeah. I mean, we don't know. I don't want to be disrespectful to Rangers, but I think Rangers fans will accept that it's a long way off. There are bigger things to sort out of that club now than challenging for league titles. You need to get a basic structure in there.
Have a plan.
They need to have a plan. Yeah, they need to have a plan. They need to get out of this horrendous rut that they're in and have a vision, like Hearts.
Mm-hmm.
Just like Hearts. That's the template.
Well, I will keep you no longer. Tom English, thanks very much.
Pleasure.
Cheers.
Little shots ring out in a barroom night. It's a Betty Valentine from the...
I hope you enjoyed that chat there between myself and Tom English. Tom is very engaging and good fun to have a chat about football with, and hopefully that has come across in the hour and a half that we've got here. I know sometimes when either myself or St Anthony have done interviews, particularly with people from the press, I'm thinking of Jim Spence or Robert Grieve or Richard Gordon that we've done recently. Occasionally on places like Kerrydale Street or on Twitter or by email, people have said, oh, why didn't you press on this or really take...